danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day when you give in. Give in. Give in. Give in.
Hello and welcome to episode 198.5 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. I'm Andrew Brokius. I will be joined for another introduction to the show by Nate Mavis momentarily, but first I need to kind of explain to you what's going on here and why this is 198.5 and not 199. So the main thing here is that we do not have a full interview recorded with Patrick Leonard. We recorded this entire episode. Nate and I recorded an introduction and a strategy segment, as we usually do. We recorded a usual, you know, roughly 1 hour in length interview with Patrick. He was great. I think we explained in the intro a little bit of how this came to pass, but it was awesome talking to him, of course. And you know, not just for the obvious reasons that he's a great and well-known poker player, but I think he was also very, you know, honest and forthcoming in a way that we appreciate from our guests, and in a way that I think gives some interesting insight into who he is and what it means to be any kind of professional poker player, including one who's kind of as high up on the food chain as he is. And then we lost a good chunk of that audio, and we've been hopeful that we might be able to recover it. We've tried a number of different things to recover it, but at this point it's looking unlikely enough that we're going to be able to recover it, that we wanted to at least share with you the part that we have. So we're not exactly counting it as a full episode, but this is a week when we probably would not have been able to get an episode out anyway, so we figured we might as well bring you what we have from the Patrick Leonard interview. Hope that you'll enjoy it. As I said, there is a full strategy segment, and you are going to hear Nate and me do another introduction to this episode coming up shortly, and I hope that you'll still find that interesting. It was recorded back in July, so I'll talk about being in California, which I no longer am, and I don't remember entirely. Maybe we talk a little bit about the WSOP or something like that. So just keep in mind when you're listening to that interview, or to that introduction rather, that it's somewhat dated, as is the interview, right? That's a couple months old now, and so, you know, we won't have talked, for instance, about the W Coupe, where Patrick had a lot of success and where his stable had a lot of success, because that happened after this interview began. But I hope that you'll still find it interesting. I think you'll enjoy the strategy segment. And yeah, that's all. Enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to episode 182 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Cambridge, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis. And with me from
I'm in Tahoe, California.
Tahoe, California. From Tahoe, California is Andrew Brokius. Wow, first time, well, not the first time being from Cambridge for me, but the first time in years, and the first time ever recording from Tahoe for you.
Yes, you should see the view that I have right now while I'm recording this.
It's probably great. It
is pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, I was, I've been to Tahoe once on my way to Reno. It was really nice.
And so what brings you to Cambridge?
My wife and I moved.
Now congratulations.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know. You're always raving so much about Somerville and how much you like Somerville.
Yeah, no, Somerville's great. For personal reasons, Cambridge is working out better for us now. A joke I like to make is that we moved from a part of Somerville that stereotypically is like Cambridge to a part of Cambridge that is stereotypically like Somerville. So there you go. But it's nice. Like it here. Big park. Good for walking the dog. So I'm happy here.
Nice. Yeah, I actually just left my apartment as well. There's a fair chance we'll be moving back to San Francisco, but Emily's between jobs right now, which was the reason that we were in San Francisco in the first place, and decided she didn't want to start looking for a new job right away. Yeah. Among other things, we haven't seen really our friends and family on the East Coast much at all since we've been in San Francisco, so we're taking about 2 weeks to do some stuff around Northern California and Oregon, which is how I'm in Tahoe right now, and then we'll be on the East Coast kind of like the month of August, and I'll probably be going to Canada for Scoop in September, and I think we just have a little time like that coming up. But yeah, we've
looking forward to it.
You and I both moved in the last week.
You're looking forward to your wandering time?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of work to do with the moving. And I mean, to be honest, she did a lot of it while I was in Las Vegas. But, you know, you and I had this conversation while I was in Vegas that I was sort of like more dreading the work than looking forward to the wandering. But yeah, now that the wandering is underway, it is certainly nice here in Tahoe, and looking forward to, you know, seeing the friends and the family. And hopefully that'll include you if we manage to make our way to Cambridge.
That would be fantastic.
So yeah, this is I think a pretty exciting show. We have Patrick Leonard on the show, and this is funny because he just randomly DM'd me on Twitter and was like, "Hey, listened to a bunch of your podcast over the last week. Great work there." And I was like, "Oh well, Patrick Leonard not only knows who we are but listens to the podcast. Seems like it would be pretty easy to get him to come on the show." And thankfully, he was willing to do that, and I think was very candid during the interview.
Great.
This is extra funny because when I was leaving Las Vegas, like literally the day that I was leaving on my way to the airport, I had to stop to fill up the tank on my rental car. And so I just saw very briefly, I was like looking at my phone as I was getting back into the car to like do the directions to get to the rental car return place. And I just like saw a notification from Skype that said I had a DM from Fedor Holtz. Talking, and it was like, "Hey, great podcast, da, da, da." And then like also asking for our input on a hand that he played, which should have been a red flag. Why would he be asking for input on a hand that he played? But I like allowed myself to think for about 15 minutes, like between the drive from the gas station to the rental car place, I allowed myself to believe that Fedor Holtz was not only listening to the podcast, but eager to hear our thoughts on some hand that he played at the Venetian. And only after I arrived at the car rental place and looked in detail did I see there was actually some other person who had changed his handle on Skype, but you know, you like your display name, you can change. He had like changed that to Fedor Holtz, and I was like, "Ah, this is like the worst slow roll of the summer." But I mean, I did feel ridiculous forever believing it, but so it was very nice to see, you know, Patrick Leonard, the real Patrick Leonard, was listening to the show and then willing to come on the show, which was just awesome, and I think a great conversation with him we have coming up.
Yeah, if he's an imposter, it's a very convincing one, because he knows a lot about Patrick Leonard. No, he did great. He was super interesting. He occupies an interesting place in the poker world and is also a really top level player. So a fantastic interview. He did great, and I'm really grateful he came on the show.
And he's self-reflective as well, you know, willing to kind of talk about issues that he's had and that kind of thing, which I think makes for a good interview. People who are willing to be honest and aren't only interested in kind of puffing themselves up or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I have a personal request this week. If you work in software, I want to know what you do. I work in software myself in a way, and I don't know enough about the industry, and I don't know enough really about what's out there. I know a lot about what's on Hacker News and other sort of trendy places, but that is probably like 0.25% of the industry. So if you are in software broadly construed, and if you are willing to talk to me about what you do, just for my own edification, for, you know, 5 to 15 minutes, I will buy you coffee, either locally here in Cambridge or in the form of some sort of like Starbucks gift certificate, if you will do it over Skype with me, presuming you can email those, which I imagine you can. I would be really grateful for it. And hopefully I'll get a sense of what's actually out there. Thank you, Andrew, for letting me take 30 seconds to do a little professional development over the podcast, if I can. Podcast at thinkingpoker.net, if you're willing to take me up on that. Thanks.
Yeah.
The World Series of Poker may be over, but that means that Nate and I have a fresh round of content to put up on Tournament Poker Edge. So over the course of the next few months, you should expect to see some content from both of us, both from the World Series of Poker and, you know, potentially from other poker that we're playing, or at least in my case, just some theory stuff I've been thinking about poker-wise. Where I'm going with this is it's a great time to sign up for Tournament Poker Edge if you're not currently a member, or if you were a member and don't currently have a paid sponsorship, this is a great time to re-up. Of course, Tournament Poker Edge is always a great source for improving your tournament poker game, and you can and should sign up today at tournamentpokeredge.com. Our strategy hand today is actually coming to us from one of our former guests, Zach Ralston. And this is a hand that he played in a 2-5 game at Caesars. He says, his image has been very tight due to two factors. One, I'm a nit, and two, I've been card dead. I think people are noticing. I bought in for $500, but almost everyone else is deeper. Thanks to the dealer who recognized me, I'm known as an ESPN producer for the WSOP, an identity that has led to some friendly table talk about television pros. Reads on the opponents. Under the gun is a young German pro who is an FOF, which stands for Friend of Fedor. Being that he regularly talks to Holtz and other guys like Rainer Kempe, I'm labeling him as smart, aggressive, and experienced. He's been active, but hasn't had to show down a hand yet. Cutoff is a loose, passive, fish-cake tourist. His wife is sitting behind him, so enough said, right? The small blind, also fairly loose pre-flop, but hasn't gotten out of line post-flop yet. She's a tournament grinder with about 200k in winnings on Hendon Mob. To start the hand, effective stacks are $500 because that's what I have and the villains all cover me. Under the Gun, who's the young German pro, opens to $20, which is a standard open at the table, and his range has been wide from all positions. Plus, Zach says, because I'm in the big blind, it's easy money. The cutoff quickly flat calls. The small blind thinks a little and flat calls. Before I look at my hand, I recognize that this is a pretty good squeeze spot. After I look at my hand, I feel the same. I have ace two of diamonds, so while I could easily just defend for $15 and take a flop four ways with a hand that plays fine multi-way, I'm happier not to play versus under the gun out of position. And since I have an ace blocker, why not squeeze and take down the dead money? I make it $85 to go. So we'll pause there before we get results. Do you agree this is a good spot to squeeze both before and after looking at his cards?
Yeah, I think it's a good spot to squeeze. I wouldn't do it with any two cards or anything like that, but I do think that given all the dynamics that your re-raise is going to get a lot of respect. I also think that it's a good spot to 3-bet because calling is not going to be a great option in a lot of situations with probably at least two players who play well, one of whom raised under the gun. You know, it's not like a lot of hands are going to play profitably, given that the standard raise is 4x. And that's also why I think that 3-betting with this hand makes some sense. I think people overestimate how well they're going to do with ace deuce suited for a 4x raise, and that the profitability of that hand has quite a bit to do with the size of the preflop raise. And I wouldn't be surprised if you could turn a modest profit with the hand calling, but I think against an under the gun raise and the fact that it's a 4x raise and not a 2.5 or 3x raise, calling is going to be somewhere between unprofitable and marginally profitable. So putting this hand into a squeeze range seems fine to me.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I would make it more than 85, in part because everybody else is deeper. So you'll have a better chance of taking it down if they have sort of less good implied odds against each other, or at least the perception of such. So I think I would make it, you know, probably 100 or 110. But other than that, I like Zach's thinking and plan here.
I think what you said about the ace two suited call is particularly important. I mean, I wouldn't fold it. Like, if you told me I wasn't allowed to re-raise, I would still call with it. But I think way too many people just always default to taking the passive option. And they're like, well, you know, calling is certainly profitable. So, you know, why do anything else? I'll just call and try to make a flush. And it's not that easy to make a flush. You know, this is a hand that plays okay in a multi-way pot. It holds its equity okay in a multi-way pot, but it doesn't have that much equity to begin with. I mean, it's still ace deuce. Like, it's not, So, you know, I think like a hand like 7-5 suited is actually a hand that I'm a lot more inclined to call rather than squeeze here. You know, it doesn't have the ace blocker, and it actually has a little bit more potential to turn into, you know, a kind of strong hand than ace two suited does. You know, ace two suited is like every once in a while, like on a, you know, your implied odds are of course very good in a situation where you manage to flush over flush someone, but that's so much to ask for, and you're only playing 100 big blind effective stacks, so it's not even like you win that much for such a rare situation as that. And otherwise, like, you know, you get a somewhat profitable bluffing situation often when you flop a flush draw because you have like the nut flush draw, and sometimes you get like a combo draw or something. But, you know, flopping a pair of aces isn't worth much to you. Flopping a pair of deuces isn't worth much to you. Even just flopping a flush draw, I mean, in a four-way pot, when the flush comes in, it's going to be hard to win money from someone who doesn't have a flush. Like, people already expect a flush to be out there. So I really think people overestimate a lot their implied odds and sort of the value of playing a hand like this in a multi-way pot. And they just sort of say, well, it's a nut flush draw, so of course it's a good multi-way pot hand. I don't think that this is like a squeeze at equilibrium or something, but I think that all the dynamics that that Zach is describing here in terms of the original raiser being just having a wide range, and then like the other two players both having wide and probably capped ranges, and himself having a tight image, I just think it all adds up to being a real good spot to squeeze. I think that the size is like, I mean, in theory, people really shouldn't be peeling that light if you only have $500 in front of you and you're making an 85. In practice, I think you're right that they kind of will. 110 strikes me as kind of a lot to risk here. 85 is probably more likely the size I would use if there were just a raise and a single call. I think the addition of that second call, you know, maybe 100, but I don't think 85 is a tragedy. But yeah, I can certainly see a case for going a little bigger.
No, I don't think it's a tragedy. If I had to pick one number, it would be somewhere between 100 and 110. But either way is fine, I think.
So he does, in fact, Zach makes it 85, as we know. Under the gun, thinks for maybe 15 seconds and folds. Cutoff snap folds. Two down, one to go. Now the small blind starts to go into the tank. Then she gets chirpy. You must have a monster, huh? Or did Gus Hansen teach you that move? The old squeeze play. I don't say anything, and she realizes that despite my chattiness when I'm not in a hand, I zip it when I'm in a hand. Eventually she flat calls. Let's pause for a second here before we go to the flop, because this is kind of significant that, you know, that suddenly she's interested in talking during this hand. How would you interpret that?
So I think it's also really important that they're all deep against each other. In it, that has a lot of bearing on what she would have re-raised the first time around, which is to say, it would be probably a more polarized range than it would be if she were also $500 deep. So I think that given that she paused and called the first time around, then got chirpy the second time around, it makes me think that she's pretty strong. And also just the fact that she called, given that Zach has been a nit and now he's re-raising, it makes me think she has a good hand. Maybe not a great hand, but a hand like pocket tens, I think, makes a lot of sense. I think ace-king offsuit is not impossible here, or actually ace-king suited is another hand, maybe even more likely to just call the first time around. A hand like ace-jack suited could also make perfect sense, where the pause means that she would have considered three-betting at a shorter depth, but then just called for perfectly good reasons in the situation that she found herself in. But I think players who are comfortable, especially, you know, a lot of tournament players who are comfortable, it often means that they have a good hand. So a hand like, you know, from ace king to ace jack, from jacks to nines, maybe a little better or a little worse. That's sort of where I would put her. And against that range, in position with an ace blocker and a suited ace, that's just fine. I think Zach's going to do okay in this spot going forward. What do you think?
I mean, I think there's sort of two reasons why she might call here. Either she already likes her hand relative to yours, or she has a hand that she's looking to improve on the flop. And I think, you know, given the size, like it's like $65 to her, nobody else called. She really shouldn't be set mining here. Like this is, it's not a very good spot for her to call with like pocket threes hoping to spike a set. You know, some people will do that and maybe she would, but I don't think she really should be doing that much. Then, I mean, there are also hands like 10-9 suited or something where she might think if you're capable of being a little wide, then like her equity can be okay. And she might just be trying to like spike a draw she can check raise all in with. So, I mean, there's some hands like that where she would be calling looking to improve on the flop. And then there are also hands where she's calling, like you mentioned, Nate, some of the stronger pocket pairs or ace king or something that she didn't re-raise pre-flop that she's now kind of thinking there's still a fair chance she might have the best hand with. And the question is, you know, does her chattiness suggest one of those things versus the other? And the chattiness seems to indicate that she's trying to figure out what kind of hand Zach has. And there's some reason why she might care about that if she has 10-9 of diamonds. But I think it's more likely, you know, given that she's sort of trying to, like, essentially feel out whether he has, you know, aces or kings or something. I think it's a little bit more likely that she has the kind of hand, like, tens or ace king that can be in good shape against a strong but not really, really, really strong range, but is in very bad shape against an extremely nutted range. So that I mean, maybe I'm being a little results oriented here, knowing the results, but I think her talk is very consistent with her, just like that it really matters to her whether Zach has kings or ace queen.
Yeah, I think that's right. I also think she can have ace queen pretty well, and I think it's a hand that's really good and is in very, very bad shape if Zach has what he's representing or trying to represent. I also think against Zach, and this is just, like, I know him, I've played with him, I would be jamming or folding a lot against this raise. Like, I think Zach's going to be pretty polarized when he makes it, and he's going to play pretty well after he makes it, and if I'm out of position with a pretty strong range just for flatting in the small blind in the first place, I'd much rather just ship it with two eights or two nines or something than call. Is that reasonable?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, obviously, you have to believe that he has some light squeezes in here as well. Yeah. Like, you don't want to just ship it into a purely value.
No.
But you don't want to call against that range either. So,
yeah. Folding, I mean, folding is possible too, but right. I think I would ship it with a fair number of hands, like maybe even ace queen sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I think she really needs to be pretty strong to call here.
Yeah.
And a lot of people won't be just because they're kind of clueless or like don't really appreciate the situation that they're in. But if we're giving her some credit, and I think that her talk, you know, does lend a little bit of strength to the likelihood of her having a strong hand, I would expect her to be pretty strong when she calls.
Yeah. Yeah. Good.
Back to Zach. Heads up to the flop, $210 in the pot, $415 behind, and I'm in position with ace deuce suited. Well, that squeeze didn't work, but what's small blind's range? I think with her speech, she's likely to be somewhat strong. Some people may call there with speculative hands like jack 10, queen 10, 9-8 suited, etc., but she was chirpy and called a tight player, so I'm leaning towards a tighter range of sevens to jacks and some ace king, ace queen hands that she elected to play this way. So I think we're, you know, Zach is more or less on the same page as us. I do think there's a big difference between jacks and sevens here. Yeah. And I think she's somewhat more likely to have the jacks than the sevens.
Yeah.
The flop comes down, seven of clubs, six of clubs, deuce of spades. I has a pair. Small blind checks. As I consider my options, I thought it was close between bet and check. But given the range I assigned her after her preflop call, there are 24 combos of eights through jacks, three combos of top set, and only 12 combos of ace-king. Remember, ace blocker. Maybe she has ace-queen in that range, so 12 more of those. But two of those ace-king, ace-queen combos are not flush draws, so it's hard to find a majority of hands that will fold to my c-bet. That said, it's hard to construct a balanced checkback range. But balance be damned tonight, and I like to make an exploitive check in order to see what developed on the turn. If she bet, I would be done with the hand. If she checked, I would expect to have the best hand a lot of the time, plus I could improve if that turn card were an ace or a deuce. Yeah, I mean, I like Zach's reasoning here reasonably well. You know, I don't, it's not correct to say, you know, I need her to fold a majority of hands, right? If we're talking about betting, you know, for instance, only half of the pot, you wouldn't need her to fold a majority of the time to, you know, potentially make that bet good. However, making ace king or ace queen fold is not necessarily that valuable to you either. I mean, those are hands that are drawing to three outs plus running outs. Maybe they're going to bluff you later, and that could be a bit of a concern, but, you know, considering how far behind we are against the hands that don't fold to a bet and how far ahead we are of the hands that are going to fold to a bet, I think that's part of the case for checking. I would be a little more interested in betting if we thought we could get her off of hands like eights through jacks, you know, yeah. if that seemed plausible. And, you know, I don't know. I feel like that would be kind of an opponent-specific thing. I would be curious to hear Zach's thoughts on exactly that question. But that would be the main thing I would be considering if I were going to bet, is like, is it realistic to think that if I, you know, bet flop, shove, turn, I can get her off of those medium pairs?
Yeah, I think that's right. And that could be done pretty cost effectively. So again, 210 in the pot, 415 behind. I think $75 will make a lot of people think with like pocket nines. And that could be a pretty well invested $75. And I think what would really swing it for me is if I thought I was never, ever, ever getting bluff raised, then I would be more inclined to bet, you know, to make that kind of bet on the flop that could get some of those medium pairs to fold. And sometimes, you know, maybe get a call out of ace king, ace queen that would then shut down, which is really ambitious, but it has a little bit of two-way value too. That said, I like Zach's reasoning, and checking is somewhere between fine and very good.
I'll just throw out one other thing, which is that you probably should be giving up sometimes in this situation. I'm not talking about with ace deuce specifically, but just like there should be some hands that you're squeezing here and then not putting another penny in once you're called. I mean, if especially if you're making an exploitive squeeze preflop, which Zach was, you kind of have to assume that your opponents are going to fold very often preflop, which means that when they don't fold, you're kind of already in a rare situation, right? So like, a big part of the value of making this raise pre-flop, like the main reason to raise this is not because we might flop bottom pair or because we might flop a flush even. The main reason to raise this is to get the pre-flop folds. So, you know, it is okay to just be done after you're called. You know, I think sometimes people feel very obligated to say like, well, I represented a strong hand pre-flop, so I have to keep representing one post-flop. I mean, if you believe your opponents are going to fold very often pre-flop and then they don't fold, what they're telling you is that they're very strong. Yeah. And, you know, it could very well be the case that the preflop squeeze is quite profitable, and that once called, the most profitable thing to do is to, you know, more or less give up, or at least like take a free card and just try to realize, you know, your 20% equity or whatever you have here. Not that you're going to realize all of that, but just, you know, take whatever value there still is in your hand, but give up on any idea of getting this player to fold. Like, I think that's a reasonable thing to do sometimes.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. Especially if you're playing against a tournament player who has an overpair, if you have an ace blocker. I mean, this person seems maybe better than the average tournament player, but for very good reason. Getting people to invest a lot of the effective stacks and then fold an overpair is not a great way to make money.
She really shouldn't be calling preflop with eights.
No,
fold a flop like this.
No, of course not. So, yeah, really like Zach's thinking, and I like the check.
Right, here's more of Zach's thinking. The turn paired the six, a heart, so no backdoor spade draw. She checked again. Okay, so maybe I do have the best hand. Perhaps I overweighted her chattiness pre-flop, and she really did peel with a speculative hand and played fitter fold post-flop. Or, despite my ace blocker, she has ace king, ace queen, and I have her reverse dominated. This added up to my decision to bet. While my range isn't very well balanced, it's hard for me to have too many very strong hands after checking the flop, I don't expect her to check raise bluff me. If she continues after my delayed c-bet, I'm likely done with the hand. It's not that I'm bluffing, very few better hands will fold, and it's not like I can expect too many worse hands to call, though perhaps ace king gets stubborn and thinks I'm airballing. But if I'm right to revise her range after checking twice and throw in all those speculative Broadway hands like Jack 10, Queen 10, Queen Jack, etc., then that's a large amount of six out hands I'd like to protect against. I don't know how I feel about this. I mean, I do think it's true that if you believe all of those Broadway hands are suddenly now in her range because she checked twice, then there's a lot of protection value in betting. I don't know that necessarily follows logically. That, like, if you didn't think she had those hands pre-flop, I don't see why the fact that she's checked twice, you know, should suddenly cause us to add all those hands to her range. Like, I think a lot of the reasons for checking the flop are still applicable here.
Yeah, I think if what she's done is strongly inconsistent with the range that you gave her, then you have to start, then you go to the meta level and wonder if there was something wrong with your model. But let's say she has pocket tens. She checks the flop because she thinks she might have aces or kings. She checks the turn because she's still scared of your range. And also she only has one more card to fade. Like, protection is less important than it would be on the flop. So it's not that hard to construct a reason why she would check, you know, ace, king, jacks, tens, nines twice. Like, it's just not that hard. If she, you know, if this were a much... Yeah, you can construct situations where you get so surprised that you have to revise your assumptions because they're sort of strongly inconsistent with your opponent's whole range or enough of it, and that's fine. That's just Bayesian thinking. But here, I think Bayesian thinking suggests that probably she has exactly what you thought she had, just some of the range is a little bit more likely, other parts of the range are a little bit less likely, and maybe the probability that she was getting, that she was goofing around pre-flop goes up somewhat, but I think that somewhat is not very much. So, yeah, I would say small Bayesian fail by Zach here, but still strong thinking.
I'm going out on a limb a little bit here, but I often find when people are betting in these situations, and I see this a little bit just with the way Zach kind of waffles, he's like, it's not really a bluff, it's not really a value bet, but I decided to do it anyway. I think there's an element of just kind of like being uncomfortable in the hand generally and wanting to end it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I sympathize with that, and I'm sure I've made bets like that myself, but it's not ideal. You know, it's not really, you still want to be trying to find the highest EV play rather than just saying, like, oh, I'll just feel more comfortable if I take the pot now.
Yeah.
Back to Zach. Okay, so how much do I bet? I settle on $115. This is about a half pot bet and leaves me with $300 back, which is still enough to threaten a large three-quarter pot size bet on the river. In hindsight, perhaps a smaller bet is preferable. Those six out hands fold to a $90 bet as often as a $115 bet, and her jack and ten hands or whatever aren't going to fold anyway, so this is probably an occasion on which to bet small. Unless my flop check was a disaster, then I think this bet size is my biggest mistake of the hand. In addition, the time she has 15 outs, two overs and a flush draw, I'm giving her almost 3-1, so she has a profitable call. That said, I can discount that part of her range slightly because she leads the turn with those 15 outers a fair amount of the time. I think he's right to want to use a smaller bet size here, given his stated purpose of betting, which is that he's not really trying to make better hands fold anyway, if he's really just a protection bet. I think, you know, the whole bit about I can still threaten $300 behind is not relevant. Yeah. We're not trying to threaten anybody. We're trying to make people fold hands that are worse than ours but have a little bit of equity in the pot. This is a situation where I might consider betting, you know, as small as $50.
Yeah, 75 is the number I would choose. I think I mentioned it as a flop bet size. And ace, king, and ace, queen, those hands have three outs against us, and plus good implied odds if we hit the ace. And that's really nice, I think. And those hands could call. So if I'm betting, it's probably to make those hands call. And I'll just assume that that's why I'm betting if I'm betting. And yeah, 70 to 80, you know, $65 to $80 somewhere is probably the size I would choose, but I could easily see an argument for 50.
And I'm sure there's some people out there who are thinking, like, "Oh, I would never use a size like that because what if she then decides to pick up and like check raise bluff me?" And there's a few things. Like, one, a lot of people just don't do that. So there's that. Two is that if she wanted to bluff, she, you know, could have bet the turn as a bluff, and she didn't do that. So I think a lot of the hands that she might bluff with are already kind of out of her range. Now, it's possible that she might have been checking the turn, planning on giving up, and then you make a small bet, and she gets it into her head that maybe she can steal the pot. If you're really that concerned about that happening, I guess I would ask you, why don't you play aces this way? I mean, if you really think that you're going to get value from better or from you know, over pairs like jacks by taking a line like this anyway, and additionally, you think that there's going to be all this value in causing someone to like spaz out and check raise bluff your small turn bet with all these bad hands. You know, I think most people don't play aces like this, and maybe you should. I mean, Zach mentioned a few times like feeling like he doesn't have a balanced range in this situation, but I think, you know, the reason why a lot of you don't play aces this way is that you don't actually believe that you're going to get check raised that often when you make this bet, when you have aces, and you only worry about it happening when you have the weekend. So I think it might be a reasonable way to play aces, actually, but regardless, I would not like freak out about playing ace deuce this way because we're so afraid that she's suddenly going to turn a hand into a check raise bluff.
Agreed.
Zach says, anyway, she thinks for a little, tries to get more out of me by talking. It doesn't work. I'm mum poker per Tommy Angelo. And she eventually calls. The river is the four of spades, making the final board 7-6-deuce-6-4 with no flushes possible. She checks a third time. Zach says, I think we can all agree there's not much of a reason to bet. So I check back and hope my pair is good, saving my last $300 in case I'm crushed. This I do agree with. I think, if anything, we got the turn bet was already too big, but I don't think there are very many hands that are calling the turn bet and then fold into a river shove.
Yeah, I agree.
Results. She turned over two queens. Sad trombone. Sorry, Zach. I think you should be happy that you had a good read preflop. And it's a tricky one. You know, a lot of people are not going to be inclined to put their opponent on such a strong hand after she passes up two opportunities to squeeze. And I know you didn't mention queens in your read, but you did mention Jack. So I think you're in the right neighborhood. I think you correctly identified that she was pretty strong based on the preflop call. And I think the biggest room for improvement is, I guess, sticking to that read that she's strong and essentially just giving up post-flop is, or if anything, you know, maybe making a smaller, if you're going to bet the turn at all, using smaller sizing. But I think just kind of going with that read that she's strong and giving up post-flop is really the way to go here.
Yeah, but good thinking and A-plus email and nice hand.
Yeah. And shall we go talk to Patrick?
Let's do it.
Excellent.
Yeah, so I just knew Budapest was a great city. Like, I mean, now I think it's the best city in Europe, in my biased opinion, perhaps. But at the time, I heard lots of good reviews. It was cheap to live as well. At the time, I was, like, relatively nitty in real life. And Budapest was a cheap place, like Eastern Europe. It had a good airport. I could fly home easily. It was close to lots of places, like close to EPTs. And it just seemed like a good place to move and play.
It seems like you still like it there.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, I think it's I've recommended a lot of friends to come and live here, so I have a bunch of friends who live here. There's maybe like 100 poker players who live here from like America, Canada, England, wherever else, expat communities. I own a bar here now, which is fun. Getting involved in a few other small businesses and stuff, so I like it here. Yeah, I'm kind of settled. Unless there's a regulation, I guess I won't move for the foreseeable future.
And the Brexit stuff doesn't affect your ability to stay there?
I mean, we don't know. I mean, I think it's unlikely Brexit will actually even happen, or it'll happen like maybe officially, but I guess nothing will change. I think the government will try to overrule that as well as they can. And if it does change, it's going to take maybe 2 or 3 years for everything to kind of fall into place anyway. And then we'll reevaluate as it goes, I guess.
Fair enough.
How do you like the small business game? Or is the stuff that you learned in poker applicable to running a bar and investing in other small businesses?
I mean, I really don't like it actually because of the ROI. Like in poker, you're used to such high ROIs. Sick brag, sorry. but in generally, you're like used to like pretty high ROIs. And with my staking company, which is the thing I spend most of my time on, we like an average ROI of maybe like 20-50%, somewhere like that. It's like realistic. So when you go to like small businesses and you try to like push 5% edges or something like this, it's hard to motivate yourself, especially like if you like put in like $50,000 into a business and you're trying to work out like pretty small edges, it's just hard to be motivated sometimes. I'm very hands off. Like I have a manager who runs it, or the guy who I invested with, he runs stuff with me. But in the future, I'm going to be more selective about what I invest in, I think. I mean, it's just really hard. Like I said, with poker, it sets like very unrealistic expectations. I'm not entirely sure how I'm going to invest money in the future. I'm really unsure. I'm always open to like opportunities and stuff like this. And I just played by ear. People have pitched stuff to me and I've been very close to investing and then pulled out at the very last second just because I've really looked into the numbers and thought, I'm not realistically going to make that much money here. I'll just keep my money elsewhere, I guess.
I guess conversely, it makes poker seem even better. Like, oh, I can go play a tournament and make 11% after expenses in just 2 days. Like that, I think after you have some time in the business world, you start to understand just how cool that is.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I would rather stake like 20 guys than on a ball, you know, because these 20 guys are going to be playing all day, every day for 1 year, you know, and they're going to have like somewhere between like 20 to 50% ROI, depending on the guy. And it's more fun. I mean, like having a ball is kind of fun, I guess. But staking someone is actually a bit more fun, like sweating them and a bit more personal. You can just sit in your pants in your room and do it rather than having to go out and be a student.
How did you get started doing the? I mean, it seems like you've got a pretty big operation now. Was that the vision when you started doing it?
Yeah. Well, I guess. I was in Budapest playing cash games, and then I decided to be a Supernova Elite because that's like over the last 4 years or so, that's what I wanted to kind of be. I wanted to be this like grinder, you know, it really, really motivated me and to be this grinder who played all day, every day and whatever. So in January of 2013, I guess, maybe 12 or maybe 13, I'm not sure. I think it was 13. I started trying to be a Supernova Elite. I think it could even be 14. I'm not sure. I'm terrible at years, but I tried to be a Supernova Elite and I was playing 8 tables of Zoom, which is pretty difficult to do, but I really enjoyed it. I'd play 8 tables of Zoom for something like 6 hours a day for basically 6 days a week. So from January through to March, I was on pace to be Supernova Elite. And then I went to play a live tournament in Nottingham, which is Dust 'til Dawn, like a really nice casino. And I think I came like 20th in this tournament. I lost something like aces versus like sevens all in pre. And then I went home to my hotel room and I told my friend, I was a cash game player this time. I never played tournaments really. I was like, fuck tournaments. I'm never going to play any of these. And he's like, yeah. That's what they all say. And I'm like, no, mate, seriously. Like these tournaments are so stupid. Like you play all day for 2 days and you get like 1.5x buy-in back or something. I was like, this is a joke. So we went out, I got drunk, and then I woke up the next day and it was like 4 p.m. or something. And my friend was grinding like a full tournament schedule. He was a tournament player. And he was like, come on and play. And I was like, there's no way I'm playing today. And he was like, no, come on, play. And I went out to get a Sunday roast. That's like my favorite meal, like a Sunday roast. It's like an English meal, like vegetables, Yorkshire puddings. And they didn't have any, the pub was closed. It was too late or whatever. So I came back to the hotel room and I was hungry. I was so tilted. And he was like, come on, just play. It's fine. Like, it's Sunday. You should play. So I just loaded up like 8 tables. And then I won like 3 tournaments, including the Sunday warm-up. So I think I won like 100K that day. And I was like, okay, maybe tournaments are not so stupid at all. But I was still really missing cash games because like when you play Zoom, like 8 hours of Zoom a day or 6 hours of 8 tables of Zoom, it's like an addiction. It's like a drug. Like you just get used to it. You really want to play this Zoom. So when I came back on the Monday, I just started playing Zoom again for like a week. I was on pace. Like I really enjoyed it. And then the next Sunday was the anniversary Sunday Million. It's like 10 million guarantee or something like this. And I still played Zoom, but I just played this tournament on the side. And then I ended up coming 9th for like another 100K or like 120K or something. And then I was like, okay, the whole year was me like grinding out this small amount of money each day to make like 100K in a year or 150K in a year with Supernova Elite. And I just made like 250K in the last 7 days playing these stupid tournaments. So I was like, okay, these tournaments are like so soft. I just have to play these instead of cash games. So I kind of transitioned and didn't play Zoom ever again, really. Maybe like a little bit, but very rarely. And then since those two tournaments, I just became like a full-time tournament player. And I mean, tournaments to me were so eye-opening because they were like cash games were like 4 years earlier. You could just make people fold a lot. You could just make people call a lot doing like different little tricks. And I was like, oh my God, these are the softest thing ever. Because no one knew who I was because I was a cash game player. So nobody had like statistics on me. So I could just play like absolutely crazy for for like 1 year, no one really had stats on me because like the player pool is so big. So I started saying to myself, okay, if it's this easy, I should just try to like stake some of the guys and teach them and see how it goes. So I started staking John Gill, this the guy you had on your podcast, very nice guy, and his friend Pat Brooks, who's another nice guy too. So I started staking them and coaching them, and it went pretty well. They made me some money, and at this point, I kind of changed my friendship group because I was playing tournaments instead of cash games. So I met these like Scandinavian guys, European, and Elmerix, who are probably like, I think, two of the top five players in the world, and definitely probably the two most underrated players in the world. And we spoke a lot about poker. I had done pretty well, but they had both made like 1.5 million playing online tournaments, and I was still learning a lot from these guys. And we decided to just start staking people together because we had some spare cash and we thought it'd be like a fun thing to do together. So I brought my two guys over, they brought their guys over, and we kind of had this like mini stable of maybe like 6 to 8 guys. And this was in like, this was around about, I guess, 18 months ago. And this started going okay. I mean, like, we made decent money, like not great. We did like lots of bad things in staking. Like, the thing is, everyone who stakes people is absolutely terrible. And we were just as bad. We were really, really bad. Like game selection, advice, like the people we took on, all this stuff. Like, we didn't do it well. But we kind of learned from our mistakes over the last year or 18 months. And now we have, I guess, maybe 80 guys or something, maybe a little bit less, like 70 guys. I'm not sure exactly how many. And we run it as a proper business. It runs really well. We have like a guy who's a CEO who runs the company. We're very involved. There's a fourth investor, oh my God, who's a friend of Europeans who came on at the start as well. And yeah, it's really fun. I mean, I don't play poker as much anymore because of the stable, because it takes up so much time and effort and interest. But it's very, very, very fun. And I'm very happy that I do it. It's very good to do with friends as well. Like, it's nice to enjoy business with friends and to do well with them.
Can you say a little bit more about what you feel like were the mistakes that you made when you first started doing it?
I mean, the thing is, in poker, like, if you need staked, generally, it's generally because you don't have money. And if you don't have money, it's generally because you're either bad at poker and you lost money, or it's because you have huge life leaks and you just can't manage money and therefore like you're immature, you approach life poorly or whatever else. And just in general. If you're just trying, if like, let's say like my mom wanted to start staking someone, the people she would stake would be people who needed money, right? So we started staking people who needed money and we started staking them and whatever. And then we kind of realized we needed to change the whole thing around and stake people who didn't need the money. So like we stake like more than like 10 guys who I stake probably have over $200,000 bankroll, but we stake them because of our coaching. We have like, there's us four guys who all play high stakes MTTs, and then we have like another 5 guys who've all made more than $1 million playing online tournaments. So we have like 10 guys who are doing really good coaching very often, and all the guys who play mid stakes look up to like these kind of 9 guys or 10 guys, and they want to kind of be in the community of these guys and be coached by these guys like 3 times a week. And we kind of offer something different to what anyone else offers, because some guys offer coaching and stuff like this, but I don't think it's like on the level what we do. Maybe that's like being big headed or whatever, but I think we've taken so many players. Like, I think people just stake people from like shark scope graphs, which is like a bad way to do it, because like if a guy's made $1 million and he wants stake, then there's like a big problem. Like, I would basically never stake someone who's up like 900K playing poker, because it's just like this, it just like sends a red flag off. I'd rather stake like a 20-year-old guy who's like really smart with like a good degree, who's maybe made like 50 or 60K playing poker, but it's very open-minded. He doesn't think he's the best player in the world. He's willing to listen. And maybe he's played like heads up sit and goes, like $30 heads up sit and goes. And now he wants to transition to tournaments, because tournaments are very easy. Like, online tournaments are a very good way to make money, and they will be for the foreseeable future. And if you're like a crush, if you're a guy who plays like NL50 Zoom and you're smart and you're young and you want to learn, then you can be like one of the biggest winners in the world in tournaments if you're willing to put the time into it, which is like a really, really great thing, because you can't do this in cash games anymore. You can't do this in sit and goes anymore. And in live poker, you can't do it either, really. So tournaments is the one place where if you're playing like $30 sit and goes or $50 Zoom or 100 heads up cash games, tournaments is the place where you can make like 200k yep without too much effort. You know, like you, if you study like 3-4 times a week and you try hard, then it's definitely possible. And we have the environment now, and we have like the tools, and we have like programs which are like our own self-built programs, which we can really find leaks in players' games very easily. And I believe that if there's a guy who wants to be a winner and he's smart enough, then we can turn anyone into like a $10 tournament player into like a $100 tournament player pretty quickly. So once we've built this kind of business model and we learned why our players were losing, why some players were winning, we just got more and more players. People recommended their friends, stuff like this. And yeah, it's just gone really well since then, I guess.
You stated very confidently in there that you thought online MTTs were going to continue to be a good way to make money for the foreseeable future. Why do you say that so confidently when you don't think that so many other forms of poker online are still good ways to make money?
Well, the thing is in poker, like no one's like happy to settle for where they are and to kind of just be happy that they are making X amount of dollars a year. Like a guy wins a Sunday Million and he's playing like $60 tournaments. Like let's say a guy's going to make 100k a year playing tournaments, playing like $50 tournaments, and then he wins a Sunday Million for like 200k. He isn't content to carry on making 100k a year playing poker. In his mind, he has to go and play EPT. So he has to go to Vegas and play like a 60k schedule. So basically anyone who wins starts playing higher and playing games which they can't beat just because they have the bankroll to play in it now. So that means if you're like, game selection is the most important thing. So like in our stable, we have good stuff to show exactly which games you should be playing. It's like the games which our guys play, they're like the best players in the games. And in their games, it's filled with either like egotistical regs or regs who are in huge makeup who are like, the thing is in tournaments, everyone is staked, like or lots of people are staked and everyone's in huge makeup. So then when they play, even if they're a good player, they have huge mental issues that even if they win this tournament, they're not going to be out of makeup. So like basically anyone who's playing tournaments is just playing bad for like a different reason. Either they're in huge makeup and they're not motivated, either they're playing stakes higher than they should be playing because they've won a tournament recently, or they're a recreational guy, or maybe they're like a guy who just doesn't study. Like the guys who are playing well in tournaments, it's the guys who are like happy to play the stakes they're playing, the guys who are studying like 3 times a week, guys who are playing more than one day a week. Like lots of guys only play on Sundays or Tuesdays, you know. If you play on like Wednesdays and Fridays and Mondays where like loads of regs are just, they don't want to play because like first place in tournaments is too small for them, then you can just make so much money on these kind of like smaller days, you know. Like it decreases the variance from the big days and from the big series if you're willing to put in the time and grind on these smaller days. And in our contracts with our players, we make them play on these like smaller days as well to learn and to study, etc., etc. In general, I don't think tournaments will be tough in the future just because I don't think people study enough in tournaments compared to cash games or whatever else. People are playing for like huge scores. They're not playing for like an hourly. In cash games, you study so your hourly is as high as possible. In tournaments, you play so you can win 100k. It's like a completely different mindset. In cash games, like you want to get the highest EV line in a certain like blind versus blind spot for like a 7 big blind pot. In tournaments, you just care about like what's up top in a tournament, you know.
What's the smallest stake tournament that you still play on a regular basis, you personally?
I guess like the big 55, or the maybe the big 44, the hot 33. Like I'll play those tournaments, like $55 freeze outs maybe, if there's like a special, something special about them. And if not, like I guess 109s and higher generally. Another thing players do poorly is they play too many tables. So like they'll play like 18 tables, and like a guy who has stake, yesterday I searched him on Stars and he was playing like the Sunday Million and he was also playing like a $2 turbo. And it just makes no sense to ever do that, you know? Right. And so many players who play tournaments, they're playing too many tables. They just want to play lots of tables, you know? But I'm more kind of play less tables and really like tune in on each table and exploit each player on each table. because like even myself, I'm very, very exploitable. Like if a guy was playing one table and he was really focusing on how to beat me, he'd be able to beat me pretty easily. But there's just everyone is playing so many tables that they don't have time to check all HUD stats and to really think about things and to see how quickly I acted and all this kind of stuff, you know. So yeah, I think in general you should play like 8 tables probably maximum, unless you're really confident. If you're playing really, really good, maybe up to 12 tables. But I think like somewhere between 6 to 10 tables is like the GTO amount of tables to play. But I think most people
can't tell you how glad I am to hear you say that. I mean, I don't play online that much anymore, and I always feel this kind of like weird guilt if I only am playing like 6 or 8 tables at a time. I'm like, I should be taking better advantage of this opportunity right now. It makes me very happy to hear this.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think anyone who's playing more than 12 tables is going to be a big winner in poker. I just don't think it's possible. I mean, you can win, but you can't really have huge ROIs and huge edges. It's just not possible. There's so much stuff you need to think about in so many different spots.
Yeah, and I don't even really enjoy it, because like the thinking about that stuff is what I enjoy. Just kind of like mindlessly clicking buttons, I don't really find that interesting.
No, not at all. I mean, it's just like I don't find that interesting at all either. I think it's just like I said, it's people trying to just play too many tables to try to get a big score, you know. They just want to get a big stack in a tournament and they chase the big stacks, you know. Like the English guys, like the English grinders, like 5 years ago or something, they used to have this thing, like, I think if it got to like 1 a.m., which is like late, and they had like 7 tables left, they would go all in on every single table until they had like a big stack in 2 tournaments, and then just focus and then just crush the last tournament, which is like obviously a ridiculous thing to do. and that's just like the mentality. People want big stacks. Like something I've always struggled with is if I have a big stack in a tournament, like let's say I have like 200k in a tournament and the average is like 120k, and then I drop to like 140k, which is still like a really, really great stack. I have the huge like mental problem is I want to get back to that 200k, you know, like I've lost these 60,000 chips and I want to get these chips back. And it's something which I struggled with for a long time. I think now I don't struggle with it anymore, but it's definitely something which I think most people in tournaments struggle with as well.
I think you see that too when people end up with short stacks. You know, they have like 7 or 8 big blinds, and that still might be more than the starting stack in the tournament. But they just basically treat it as zero. You know, they're just like upset that they're short stacked. Like, I'll just go all in next hand, whatever I have.
For sure, that's the biggest mistake I see people in tournaments making is like shoving too wide with like shallow stack sizes. You know, like if you have like 10 big blinds, like you're only like 2 double ups away from having like 50 big blinds when you take into account like antes and like raise folds and stuff like this. And 50 big blinds in a tournament is just like so much. And people punt off like 10 big blind stacks so often, or call too wide and just gamble or whatever else. Yeah, it's one of the biggest mistakes. Like some guys had like 40 big blinds and he's gone down to 10 big blinds and now he just wants to gamble these 10 big blinds no matter what, because he needs to get back to 50 big blinds.
How do you split your time now between, I mean, it sounds like you're pretty enamored of the kind of mid-stakes online MTT world in terms of making money there. I mean, do you do a lot of the like high roller live stuff or, you know, live stuff in general?
Yeah, I mean, live poker and me, I mean, we have an interesting relationship. I've played a lot of live cash games and done very well. I've played a lot of tournaments and had like mixed results. I mean, live tournaments to me are just like complete joke. I mean, I don't know. It's like playing like 1/100th of the stake, like 1% of the stake online. It's just like absurdly soft, but at the same time, it's very frustrating if you don't do well, because it's so soft and you know your ROI is so huge and you just want to realize that edge. But then again, it's very hard to realize that edge because you put in so little volume. A big thing for me was I wanted people to think I was very good at poker. Like, it was very important to me that people thought I was good at poker. And that's why I tried to be like number 1 in the world on Pocket Fives, and I really went for that. And then when I got that, people kind of respected me, whatever. And then I wanted to do the same in live poker. And it's just not as easy in live poker because you can only play like 1 tournament a day or whatever, you know, like 1 big tournament every like month or something. So like I suffered quite a lot of mental issues, or like I was like kind of sad. I mean, I wrote this thing about how I was like depressed because I was running bad in live tournaments, and people took that the wrong way. Like they thought I was like saying I was like clinically depressed and that I should be like, I should never say this in public when I've like made so much money in online tournaments and ran well and stuff like this. But I wanted people to think that I could do it live as well. Like, I didn't want people to think I was like a live fish, because I actually think I'm better at live tournaments than online tournaments because I play exploitatively and I'm pretty confident and stuff. But I didn't have any live results for a long time, and I kind of felt like people would be like thinking I was just, I wasn't adapting well to live poker, and that was really tough for me to kind of swallow. So I started going around playing EPTs. I think I've played maybe 15 EPTs and I've never cashed one. So that's like 75K to the EPT community. I've played like a bunch of high rollers there. Like, I've played a 50K. I've played probably like five 25Ks and maybe five or 10 Ks. I haven't cashed any of those. So that's like another 200K to that community. So like, I always wanted to just do well in one of these tournaments. And there was a tournament in Monte Carlo. I think it was a 50K or 25K. It was the end of the day. And I think I was like maybe fourth in chips, and Dan Smith was like eighth in chips. And I got it all in pre-flop, kings versus ace jack, and he hit an ace on the river. And this was for like a chip lead pot. And I didn't care about the money or losing the money. All I wanted to do, like when I got it all in pre-flop, I was like, yes, I'm going to go down as a chip leader in the 50K overnight with a huge stack, and people are going to think I'm actually good at this game or something, you know? And I had just this huge mental problem that I was like approaching it in the wrong way. Like, I wasn't making decisions differently or anything, but afterwards, if I wasn't succeeding, it was making me like very sad. Like, I remember I lost a hand and I was walking back to my hotel room in Monaco and feeling like really sad. I just really wanted to win that hand so badly. Not because my EV in the tournament would now be like 250K, but I wanted to kind of be recognized that I was good live as well as online, you know? So that was like a big problem I had for a long time. Since then, like, I really don't care anymore. But
yeah. How did that happen? How did you go from having that problem to not caring anymore?
I'm not sure, actually. I think I just stopped giving a fuck. I'm not sure how. I started using Elliot Rowe, who was like a mental coach, and yeah, I mean, he didn't really focus too much on that stuff, but just over time, I think I've just become more rational. Like, I've understood variance more. I understand how it is, and I care more now. Basically, when I play poker, I want to win every single hand I play. But that doesn't mean I want to like win the pot, you know? Like, I want to like fold in the river with the second nuts can be winning the hand if I win it against my opponent, you know? So like, right now I'm always very motivated to win every single pot and to be really tuned in and focused. And I guess Elliot kind of helped me with that. So my goal now isn't to be recognized as the best player in the world or whatever. It's just to really like be confident and proud in my own game and my own success and my own decisions.
And you know that you are recognized as one of the best players in the world.
I think I'm respected, but I think still people will think that I'm not as good live as I am online or something like this, which is still like deep down some form of issue in my mind.
Have people actually said that to you?
And, probably, I don't think so, but I just know, like, I mean, I would think the same thing, you know, like, I would think the same thing. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think a lot of this is in your head.
Yeah, potentially. Potentially. Like, I think the day before I flew back to Vegas, there was a 25K in Aria. I think I came six or something. And I got it all in with queens against eights against Igor Kognov. And this was probably for, like, top two in the tournament. And I really wanted to win the pot again at the time, not for the money, but I wanted to be recognized as, oh, yeah, this Patrick's won, like, the high roll in Aria or something, you know, which is, like, completely ridiculous to think about. And maybe it's, like, some kind of ego inside me or something. I've got no idea. It's definitely something that I guess I still struggle with a little bit. It's definitely not 100% out of me. So yeah, I'm not sure.
Was there anything else that you wanted to talk about that we haven't gotten around to?
No, I guess now just, I guess Poly Poker, I should speak about them a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, so your role there is ambassador. What does that mean exactly?
I mean, I've always kind of had blogs on forums and been like active on Twitter and had like followings and stuff like this. And I've had like a few approaches from different companies to like be an ambassador for their site. But I've been very uncomfortable supporting a site who I didn't believe in 100%. I didn't want to just get like a paycheck to say, oh yeah, to tweet like lol, poker, whatever, you know. Like, I didn't want to be that guy who accepted the paycheck. And then Party kind of got taken over a little bit by Rob Young. He had a lot more involvement, and he he spoke to me about how he wanted Party to be within like 1 year, 18 months, etc. And I was really happy to kind of be on board. And he comes from the live game. So like he owns Dusk Till Dawn Casino, which is probably the best casino in Europe. And he had really good intentions for online poker, but he just didn't get it. He's never grinded online. And he wanted someone who could come in, he could just ask questions to, who would know the answer. Because I have like a decent following, because I've been grinding and blogging a lot, also like in combination with like being a poker consultant for like 2 years, it's kind of like a good mix for Party, because I can tell them like something without just like, I can give them information without like just saying it, without kind of like my own prerogative, do you know what I mean? Like I'm not giving them information because I want high stakes MTTs to be better so I can make money. I can give them like good information with like facts and like quantitative information so they can like help their whole website, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think they like that. And I enjoy making like a difference for the site. In terms of my responsibilities, I just have to kind of be kind of a face for the site, and also like behind the scenes, just like give them as much information and feedback on like, they have like an online, a web app, like a mobile app, which is going to come out in the next few weeks. And then I play on it for like a week or so. Then I give them information like, oh yeah, you need to change this really quickly. Like the regs will already hate this, or you need to change this. The recs will really not like to use this kind of thing. And I like it. I'm not sure how long the relationship will stay for. Hopefully it'll last for a long time. As long as Party keep being in, having good intentions and having the recreational players' beliefs and kind of their lifespan in their intentions, I think I will be happy to stay on board and help improve their side. I think it's important that there's competition in poker. I think PokerStars had a monopoly for a little bit too long. And I think also 888 are doing a good job. I'm fine to give credit to other sites as well. It's not like I'm just playing on Party Poker. I'm still playing on other sites too. And I would actually like it if there was like two more sites who came out and started giving competition too. I think Party would be happy with that as well. Competition is definitely a good thing in this industry, in my opinion.
So you mentioned your blog a few times. Where can people find that?
I blog on 2+2, on the Poker Goals and Forums Challenge. It's called Bracelet Hunting, I think. I think I started it when I wanted to to get a bracelet, which I came close to a few times, but not close enough, unfortunately.
I'll get a link to that in the show notes.
Nice.
Well, thanks so much for talking to us. This has been, we really appreciate when people are willing to be, you know, candid about the stuff that they struggle with as well. And I think it's important for people to have a more realistic sense of what, you know, the poker world looks like and what being a professional poker player looks like. And I think it's certainly for me, and I imagine for a lot of people, it's kind of in some ways nice to hear that even someone as successful as yourself still sorts of kind of struggles with that, like, oh, what if people don't think I'm as good as I think I am, or that kind of thing.
Yeah. I think everyone in poker has some kind of mental issues. I mean, if you look at Fido Holtz, he lost a pot like a month ago or something, and he threw his chips across the table or something like this. Like, everyone suffers, like even the best players in the world and the strongest willed players in the world, everyone suffers. So if you're a grinder and you have problems yourself, don't just think you're this like tilt monkey. Like, everyone suffers the same thing. It's just the industry we live in. I guess it's any industry. Like, in any job, I think everyone gets tilted and angry and demotivated. Poker is just another job at the end of the day, I think.
The first summer that I ever did like a lot of WSOP prelims, because as long as I could play online poker, I was never that interested in doing WSOP stuff. It was really only after Black Friday that I started doing a lot of WSOP stuff. And I had been in, it's like you say, with live poker, like, you know, whiffing for 2 weeks straight is really not, you know, that's like 12 tournaments or something. It's not really that big of a deal. But you know, I hadn't cashed anything, and I was playing at a table with Vanessa Selbst, and she just, the story isn't important, but she like blew up about something pretty ridiculous and was just kind of like, you know, ranting to no one in particular for a few minutes. And I just had this realization. It was so reassuring to me to be like, I'm having a better summer than Vanessa Selbst is. And I'm holding it together better than she is, you know?
Yeah. That's true. That is true.
Yeah. Well, thanks again. And all the best to you in the future.
Thanks, guys. Thanks
very much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Nate. Bye.